Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is April 5th, 2019, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Nothing Compares to You, because there was no comparison group. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Ryan Radecki. He is an emergency physician at Kaiser Permanente Northwest, co-host of Annals of Emergency Medicine podcast, and Journal Club selection editor. Welcome back to the SGM, Ryan. It's been a while.
It's about 3 years, I think. 100 podcasts ago, Obama was still president of the United States, and the United Kingdom was still part of Europe.
The world has changed, hasn't it? Well, what have you been up to? I know you're co-hosting this Annals of EM podcast with Rory, and we're only going to say nice things about Rory, but what else have you been up to?
Oh, yeah, that other podcast we do sometimes. It's hard to say that's new, because now we've been doing that for almost 3 years now, too. Let's see. The baby I had is no longer a baby, and then we had another baby, and she's hardly a baby anymore either. But still at Kaiser, still in Portland, still just taking it one day at a time.
Well, you took that whole go forth and multiply, literally, but I appreciate you taking some time to do this afternoon, because you have a big afternoon planned. You're taking a field trip, and I think you're actually going out into a field. You're going on a farm trip or something?
Yes, unlike you, who lives out in the rural areas, the city folk have to go like a field trip to the farm. There's going to be piglets and baby goats and lots of mud.
I remember one time I had a student come up and do a one-month rural elective with me, and she said, "Oh, Dr. Milne, this is so cool. The closest I've ever gotten to a cow is the dairy section in the grocery store."
Consider yourself lucky.
Well, we won't belabor the banter. Why don't you give us a case?
All right, I've got a case set up. And the answer is, you are caring for a 72-year-old man who comes in after having slipped on the ice. A routine evaluation finds only minor bumps and bruises, but includes a rather nasty one on his occiput, where he struck a step. He reports he has been taking a Pixaban to prevent stroke in the context of atrial fibrillation, which you easily recognize as one of the modern oral anti-factor 10A inhibitors. You order a non-contrast CT to rule out hemorrhage, and you are rewarded with it demonstrating a 7mm subdural hematoma with 3mm of midline shift. As you are reassessing your patient and treatment plan, the question presents itself. How should we reverse his anticoagulation?
Well, more and more patients are being treated with direct oral anticoagulants, the DOACs, and I know some people are still referring to them as the NOACs, but how long do we keep calling them novel or new? But the number of people who are on DOACs will probably increase since the updated guidelines for atrial fibrillation from the AHA now contains the following recommendation. NOACs are recommended over warfarin in NOAC-eligible patients with atrial fibrillation, except with moderate to severe mitral stenosis or a mechanical heart valve.
And of course, one of the concerns clinicians had with DOACs was that there was no way to reverse these new anticoagulants when they were introduced. In contrast, protamine could be used for heparin and low molecular weight heparin reversals, and then vitamin K, fresh frozen plasma, and prothrombin concentrate complexes can be used to reverse Coumadin.
This changed in 2015 when the Food and Drug Administration approved idariciximab for the reversal of dabigatran. Dabigatran is a direct thrombin inhibitor, and we covered the interim analysis of 90 patients included in a prospective cohort study by Pollack et al. In the New England Journal of Medicine, and that was on SGEM 139. Our bottom line for that episode was that idariciximab is here in the United States and probably works, but its patient-oriented efficacy and safety are still pending.
I'd actually believe that was the last time I was actually on the SGEM. And since then, the full study cohort of 503 patients has since been published. That's Pollack et al. New England Journal of Medicine 2017. And we are in the same place we were in 2015. Idariciximab clearly and effectively removes dabigatran from circulation, and this ought to be occasionally clinically useful. I would certainly exhaust all potential supportive and expectant management options first, as well as try to definitively confirm dabigatran as the culprit for abnormal hemostasis.
Well, the FDA granted an accelerated approval for adexanet in May of 2018, and it's an antidote for factor 10A inhibitors like rivaroxaban, apixaban, edoxaban. It acts as a decoy and binds to the factor 10A inhibitors.
And the American College of Cardiology has published a fact sheet to provide some guidance for the use of anticoagulation reversal agents. We will put a link in the show notes.
So, Ryan, what's the clinical question?
Should andexanet alfa be used to treat serious bleeding events in patients taking factor 10A inhibitors?
And the reference?
That's Connolly et al., full study report of andexanet alpha for bleeding associated with factor 10A inhibitors, published in the New England Journal of Medicine this year in 2019.
Let's run through the PICO. What was their population?
Well, this is adult patients presenting with an acute major bleed and had received a DOAC, apixaban, rivaroxaban, edoxaban, or any dose of enoxaparin at a dose of at least 1 milligram per kilogram of body weight per day within the previous 18 hours.
And they specifically define what an acute major bleed is, and I'll put that in the show notes. And there were a number of exclusions. What was the intervention?
Andexanet intravenous bolus over a period of 15 to 30 minutes, followed by a two-hour infusion of the drug, and the doses were modulated depending on the recency of the dosing for either the DOAC of choice.
And here's the question. What did they compare it to?
They compared it to nothing. There was no comparison group.
All right, let's go through the outcomes. They had co-primary outcomes for efficacy. What were those?
Yeah, so they've got two co-primary outcomes. One is the percent change in anti-factor 10A activity after andexanet treatment, and the other one being the percentage of patients with quote-unquote excellent or good hemostatic efficacy at 12 hours after the end of the infusion.
And how about their primary safety outcomes?
Death, thrombotic events, and the development of antibodies to andexanet or to native factor 10 or factor 10A at 30 days.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, in patients with acute major bleeding associated with the use of a factor 10A inhibitor, treatment with andexanet markedly reduced anti-factor 10A activity, and 82% of patients had excellent or good hemostatic efficacy at 12 hours, as adjudicated according to pre-specified criteria. End of quote. All right, let's run through the quality checklist for observational studies. The first question, Ryan, did the study address a clearly focused issue?
Oh, no. So the authors muddy their evaluation of andexanet by having these co-primary efficacy outcomes.
Well, did the authors use an appropriately method to answer their question?
Well, it's a little hard to tell. So serial sampling of anti-factor 10A activity is an appropriate method for observing the pharmacokinetic effects of the andexanet bolus and infusion. But their methods for evaluating the hemostatic efficacy are less effective, as this single-arm trial affords no comparison between those treated with andexanet and those who might be managed by usual care without.
Was the cohort recruited in an acceptable way?
No, and we'll get into that.
Was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes. The exposure to factor 10A within the reported time frame was measured by the surrogate of circulating anti-factor 10A levels. This is reasonable entry criteria to their efficacy analysis and actually resulted in exclusion of nearly a third of their cohort.
The fifth question is, was the outcome accurately measured to minimize bias?
Well, yes and no. The pharmacokinetic outcomes are accurately measured. With regard to good or excellent hemostasis, however, these are based on their predefined hemostatic efficacy criteria for each bleeding location and determined by at least two members of an independent adjudication committee. But then these are just sort of, you know, arbitrary labels with intrinsic biases conveying value judgments based on these definitions of, say, percentage of ICH expansion or a certain percentage hematocrit decrease.
Have the authors identified all important confounding factors?
No.
We're getting a lot of no's here. Okay, number 7, the follow-up of subjects, was it complete enough?
I'd say yes. For the follow-up of safety outcomes, I'd say it was sufficient within a 30-day safety window.
How precise are the results?
Well, unsure. So there's only 249 patients in this efficacy cohort, so the 95% confidence interval for their 82% quote-unquote good or excellent hemostasis ranges from 77 to 87%. And then the matter of precision of their measurement instrument is another matter for consideration.
Do you believe the results, Ryan?
Well, I mean, yes. Their observations of anti-factor 10A levels are likely reliable. There's likely some variability regarding this interpretation of hemostatic efficacy, but, you know, based on the pre-specified criteria, I don't think that's going to be very large. But then there's this sort of believability. I mean, the accurate authors are likely accurately reporting their findings, but these are in turn affected by all these protocol changes they had and the other biases in this paper.
Well, can you apply these results to your local population?
Yeah, that's the difficulty. No. It is unlikely these results can be applied to your local population given the constraints placed upon entry into the study. The response to infusion regarding anti-factor 10A levels is probably generalizable, but these were not found to be specifically predictive of hemostatic efficacy. Furthermore, it's uncertain whether these determinations of hemostatic efficacy actually amount to clinically meaningful hemostasis or improved outcomes.
All right, the 11th and final question. Do the results of this study fit with other available evidence?
This is to say that the pharmacokinetic data fits with prior publications, which are all mostly by Portola Pharmaceuticals, mostly describing Andexanet's ability to bind factor 10A inhibitors. This is well described in animal and preclinical study. The evaluation of hemostatic efficacy is described in their interim study publication, as well in small animal model studies. But unfortunately, these data stand in isolation and cannot be readily compared with other strategies for management of patients with major bleeding and concomitant use of factor 10A inhibitors.
Well, those were the 10 questions. Let's go through the key results. They enrolled 352 patients into the study, and the mean age was 77 years, and 80% of the patients were taking anticoagulation for atrial fibrillation. Two-thirds of the patients had intracranial hemorrhages, and one-quarter had GI bleeds. What was the big result?
Well, the top-line result is Andexanet alpha decreased anti-factor 10A activity, and 4 out of 5 patients had excellent or good hemostasis.
All right, so let's go through those co-primary outcomes.
So, firstly, excellent or good hemostasis occurred in 204 of 249 patients, 82%. And then, for the other co-primary outcome, it decreased anti-factor 10A activity from 149.7 nanograms per milliliter to 11.1 nanograms per milliliter, a 92% reduction, which they say is excellent.
Of course, it sort of dazzles us with numbers like, wow, look at that, 150 down to about 10. But does that matter clinically? But we'll get to that. Okay, how about the primary safety data outcomes like, I don't know, death?
Well, there was some death. 14% of the total cohort died, 49 out of 352.
And thrombotic events?
Yeah, there were 34 out of the 352 that were adjudicated to have had a thrombotic event, or 10%.
And how many developed antibodies to Andexanet or to native factor 10 and factor 10A?
Well, at least that's good news. There was none of that.
Okay, so let's move on from this result section into the talk nerdy section. And we're not going to specifically talk about the fact that this was an industry-funded study and that the authors listed multiple conflicts of interest. I've said it enough times on the SGEM that it doesn't necessarily make the data wrong, but it should make us more skeptical of the results and the interpretation. But we are going to go through 5 nerdy points, and the first one is about recruitment. And an important first step to any study is the recruitment of the subjects into the study. And there were multiple problems with the recruitment, most predominantly including multiple changes to their inclusion and exclusion criteria.
Yeah, the authors amended these criteria 4 times over the duration of the study as they were enrolling between 2015 and 2018. One key change was during 2016 and 2017 when the authors restricted enrollment to only patients with intracerebral hemorrhage in order to, and this is their specific wording, they wanted to enrich the study with these patients.
Yeah, the intent to enrich the study population with intracranial hemorrhage could be in response to observations regarding its lack of ability to improve control of extracranial hemorrhage. After all, the underlying theory behind its efficacy is that the short period of restored hemostasis will allow for clot formation that is sustained following cessation of the infusion and subsequent drop in anti-factor 10A activity.
Yeah, and that's more likely to be efficacious than, say, a small volume bleed into a closed space, such as intracranially. However, is this actually any better than alternative strategies recommended by, you know, the neurocritical care societies, such as the strategies using prothrombin concentrate complexes? You know, well, that exact question is being addressed by a clinical trial that has only just now started enrollment, which means our data regarding Andexanet's true clinical effectiveness is going to remain uncertain until its completion.
Well, there were other substantial changes made during the study in the recruitment of patients, making it hard to generalize the results to the entire cohort. But let's get to point two, and this is about their co-primary outcome. As the SGEM listeners know,
there can be only one.
And it started out as having just one primary outcome, but then they amended their study to have these two co-primary outcomes, one of which is ostensibly a surrogate for the other. The percent change in factor 10A activity is a simple pharmacokinetic evaluation and not typically the purpose of a phase 3 clinical trial. But the original primary outcome was rate of hemostatic efficacy, but it was assessed at 24 hours at the start of the Andexanet bolus. The change in anti-factor 10A activity was considered a secondary efficacy endpoint. It was then elevated to one of two co-primary outcomes, and the hemostatic efficacy was changed from 24 hours to 12 hours. They state in the supplementary appendix that these changes were made based on regulatory feedback.
Another thing about the efficacy outcome was that they found no relationship, and I'm going to say that again, no relationship between hemostatic efficacy and the reduction observed in anti-factor 10A activity in all patients. This seriously calls into question the clinical impact of Andexanet. Now, there was a weak association with the subgroup analysis of patients suffering intracranial hemorrhages, and this should be viewed as hypothesis generating. The third point is about confounding factors. This was an observational study, so we must always consider confounders that could be responsible for the results seen.
And the authors consider a handful of factors influence their pharmacokinetic and clinical outcomes, but there is substantial variation within the cohort observed. They generally describe the influence and outcomes as relates to bleeding site and baseline anti-factor 10A levels, but they otherwise do not include a detailed evaluation of other individual patient features predicting hemostatic efficacy.
All right, the fourth point is about harm, and whenever we're considering a new drug, we should always consider the harm.
The safety outcomes were rather concerning as well. I mean, 34 thrombotic events within 30 days, and half of these cases were arterial thrombosis, such as myocardial infarction. And then there's 49 deaths within 30 days, and they say 35 of these are from cardiovascular causes. I'm a little bit curious about this, because this is kind of a mismatch between this cardiovascular deaths, and then there are reports of only 7 myocardial infarctions and 5 pulmonary embolisms. So there may be some harms related to Andexanet that are just not fully captured by their counting of thrombotic events or their categorization of safety outcomes.
And the fifth and final point we wanted to talk about in the nerdy section, and this is the big one, no comparison group. The lack of an active comparator is the biggest limitation of this study. How do we know if this is any better or worse than usual care?
Yeah, this study joins REVERSE AD as one of the least informative trials in recent memory. Like REVERSE AD, the one we've talked about before featuring idarucizumab, this is a single-arm assessment of efficacy without a comparator. However, unlike REVERSE AD and dabigatran, there are viable management strategies for the treatment of anti-factor 10A-associated bleeding. There is clinical equipoise for a comparative trial, and this impermanent underlying pharmacology of Andexanet, it's on and off sort of as with the infusion, suggests it ought to be substantially less effective than idarucizumab, which actually permanently binds to dabigatran. In fact, it might even be, and I'm speaking as the chair of the Institutional Review Board at my institution, that rather than not having equipoise for a trial, it may have been unethical to perform this trial and expose participants to this experimental intervention without creating substantial generalizable knowledge.
Why don't you tell us how you really feel, Ryan? So let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SJAM's conclusions.
Well, the author's conclusion is factual and narrow and accurately reflects the definitions in their protocol. And Dexinet Alpha clearly does bind circulating anti-factor 10A during administration and as I expected, rapidly diminishes afterwards. According to their arbitrary criteria for classifying patients as having good or excellent hemostasis, patients met those criteria 82% of the time. The clinical relevance of their criteria, however, as well as the utility of Dexinet Alpha, remain unclear.
So then give us a bottom line.
The routine use of Dexinet Alpha in the management of bleeding patients on factor 10A inhibitors cannot be recommended at this time.
So how are you going to resolve that case that you presented?
Well, the patient is treated, according to local protocol, established by our neurocritical care physicians, with fixed-dose prothrombin concentrate complexes and is admitted to the intensive care unit for ongoing monitoring of his neurologic status. A repeat CT shows a small amount, less than 20%, increase in size of a subdural hematoma, representing excellent hemostasis. His neurologic status remains unchanged, and within 24 hours, the patient is discharged from the intensive care unit to the medical floor to complete planning for discharge.
Now, how are you going to take this study and apply it clinically?
Well, there is no obvious clinical application for Dexinet Alpha. At $25,000 to $50,000 US dollars per dose, it should really first demonstrate superiority with regard to current management strategies of factor replacement using prothrombin concentrate complexes. There may be a subset of patients, specifically those with certain types of intracranial hemorrhage or closed space bleeding, whose hematoma growth is attenuated with Dexinet Alpha in a clinically important fashion, but this cannot yet be determined from the evidence provided at present. The most important problem with clinically applying this study is just that lack of a comparison group.
So what are you going to tell the patient at the bedside?
Well, we're just going to tell them that the patient and the family need to be informed of the presence of life-threatening intracranial bleeding and the limitations in our current management options. We will be providing care using the best evidence and recommendations available, which involves treatment with PCCs and vigilant supportive care in the intensive care unit.
Time to announce the Keener Contest winner. And I have to tell you, Ryan, there were so many correct answers last week to the Keener question. Clearly, there are a lot of nerds that listen to the SJEM, but Mark Sheeran knew that the Turing test was designed to determine whether a computer shows signs of artificial intelligence. He was first, so he wins the Cool Skeptical Prize. What's the question this week?
What was the first synthetic direct 10A inhibitor marketed as a drug?
And if you know the answer, be really keen, be that gunner. Get that answer to me as fast as you can, because the first person with the correct answer will receive a Cool Skeptical Prize. There are other FOMED resources on this issue, and I'll list those in the show notes. But thank you, Ryan, for coming back to the SJAM. I hope we don't have to wait as long next time.
That was going to be my comment. I hope it's not another 3 years before I'm invited back.
Well, maybe I could have you back for an SJAM Extra, and you could tell me all about what you learned on today's field trip to the farm.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of nerdy listeners who are interested in hearing about that. City Slickers 3.
Well, we could talk about poos, patient-oriented outcomes, doos, disease-oriented outcomes, go to the loo, because, of course, you've had the poo and the do, and, of course, you are going to the farm, so we can talk about the moos, the monitored-oriented outcomes.
Yes.
All right, so why don't you give us the SJAM tagline before you head out and muck around in the farm?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.